time to talk to Hayden Donnell for Midweek Media Watch. Kia ora, good evening, Hayden.
Kia ora, Karen.
The Sam Uffendale scandal, you don't want to talk about him, but you'd like to start by speaking a bit about the credit, or the lack thereof, for the story.
Yeah, I will speak about him eventually, but I'd just like to note first that this story was broken by the Stuff journalist Kirsty Johnston, who actually managed to put together two blockbuster stories within a six-hour window on Monday. So the first of those was about migrant fruit pickers from the Pacific who'd been forced to live in cold, miserable conditions while being told they had to work while sick during the pandemic. And that would have been enough for a day's work for most people. But then the story on Uffendale came out hours later, and it's shaped the news agenda since, obviously. So, I mean, I'd like to award Johnston the coveted Midweek Media Watch Award for exemplary journalism and offer her our congratulations. But I would note that it's kind of unfortunate, though, that other media entities haven't quite gone to the same lengths, because many of the organisations that initially followed this story, including One News, RNZ's Morning Report, News Hub, they all failed to credit Stuff, and they instead initially attributed this story to a report, you know, a vague, you know, a report. That's unfortunate, I think, especially given Stuff is still the only outlet that's interviewed Uffendale's victim at King's College. And so much of the other reporting is secondhand. It's relying on that, and it wouldn't be possible without that original work. So really best practice to credit it.
Yeah, good point. And how would that sound in a sentence?
I mean, just the story first reported by Stuff. I mean, there's some...
Kirsty Johnston at Stuff, right.
I don't think you have to say Kirsty's name if you don't want to, but you do have to say Stuff, and you should link to the story, I think. I mean, it would be great to say Kirsty's name. But, yeah, there wasn't many that actually did that, and that's something of a curse, I think, in New Zealand journalism. I don't know if you saw with David Farrier's reporting on Arise Church, there was a lot of that where he would break a story and then media later churches responded to David's reporting, would report new developments as if they were new and they were almost happening in a vacuum. And I found that quite odd, and so did David Farrier, obviously. You know, it's Anna Fifield, the Dominion Post editor. She spent much of her career working overseas. She tweeted that it's been a surprise seeing how little our news organisations credit each other here. And look, I actually tried to look into this issue of attribution in the past, because it just keeps cropping up. People keep complaining about it. Everyone's kind of angry at each other. And I eventually just decided to abort my mission because it got a bit hard, and, you know, I can't do that. But I did ask a few media organizations for their policy. The Herald said it has policies actually mandating it. And to its credit, though, it was one of the few that did, you know, credit Johnston's work on this one. Stuff has a policy mandating attribution as well. But it does seem like these policies aren't always followed, or at least are not followed consistently. And I just find that kind of sad, because it's not just sad, it's also self-defeating, because what goes around comes around, right? If everyone credits, everyone wins, we all get each other's clicks. The Cold War, I think, on attribution must end. I'm appealing for an armistice, a peace treaty right now.
In practical terms, though, Hayden, a story as big as this and as often repeated as this, you couldn't do it for every report.
No, I don't think, and especially once you've got your own sources and you're stacking up your own stuff. And look, that was the case with the Rise as well. I didn't think that every report should have been, you know, credited to David. But when there was actual actions from Arise that actually arose out of David's reporting, sometimes he still wasn't mentioned, which was weird, and it actually gave readers a less complete picture. In this case, when you're really relying on another organization's work, you haven't done your own work, you should credit them. And once you've done your own, you can get on with, you know, just writing the story as normal.
Sounds fair. There was also an insinuation that this story might actually be part of some coordinated political hit job.
Yeah, and I just wanted to touch on this briefly. There was Patrick Smalley, Business Desk's founder. He wrote a sort of, I don't know whether I'm misinterpreting, it was a bit vague, but he said, you know, this could be considered a leak designed to deflect from the government. Tim Beveridge on Newstalk ZB, he was more explicit. He just said, I think most of us would accept this as a calculated and well-timed political hit job. And he was on a panel at that time with Jack Tame, who, to his credit, rounded on him relatively strongly over that. And I just want to say, you know, Kirsty Johnston's given a pretty clear timeline of how the story came about, and it's just not true that it's some sort of coordinated political hit job. She's not a gallery reporter. I kind of have some detail on how it came about. It was a long process. It's not like one of those things that was timed for poll day or whatever. And so I just think with this kind of thing, I'd caution that it's pretty insulting to insinuate that a fellow journalist or indeed like alleged victims are participating in a planned political attack. And that's particularly if you don't have any facts to back that up.
Well, attribution and story origin aside, there's been some debate when the story first broke, perhaps not today, about whether it should have been a story at all, given how long ago it took place.
Yes, I think there's been debate all along. Even today, there was some. I mean, this was the big complaint from commentators over this saga, and I'll just highlight a few bits of audio. But when the story first broke, Heather DePlessy-Allen, she carried out a pretty good interview with Sam Uffendale, and it covered some important points, but I thought it was interesting how it ended. So this is how that went.
I'll talk to my team and obviously the leadership and reflect from there.
All right. Sam, thank you for turning up to have a chat to us about it. I appreciate it, mate.
Little thing. I appreciate it, mate. You know, obviously a bit of collegiality there. And DePlessy-Allen, she went on to write a column headline, 16-year-olds make bad decisions. And she emphasized the need for compassion over old offenses. And she actually said that explicitly tonight, that he shouldn't be punished for what he did when he was 16.
I just want to quickly interject here with a text that's come in from Kathy. Sam Uffendale, I'm seriously concerned about the revelations this week, but I hope to goodness someone's looking after that man's mental well-being. It's been wall to wall. The media has done their job. Now let's leave it to the review and come back when it's done.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of people's... I can see why you'd think that now as well. It has been wall-to-wall, it has been pretty tough, and it's something that happened a long time ago. And I'll go into a few reasons why I think the media has covered it, and why I think that it was legitimate, that they have covered it like they have. So, I mean, Heather DePlessy-Allen, she's not the only one that has sort of said something like that, that it's so long ago, why are we covering it now? I mean, in Stuff, the former chaplain of King's College, he sort of took a bit of a similar stance. He dismissed complaints about widespread bullying at the school with that, you know, that classic line, boys will be boys. Commentators, they've stuck to that, even as the story has developed. I mean, as you know, this morning RNZ aired further allegations from one of Uffendale's former flatmates, who said he beat on her door while yelling obscenities until she fled out the window, and then she moved out of the flat with her dad's help the next day. And this is it. Even today, the platform's Martin Devlin, he was complaining, why is the media dominated by people talking about what he called flatting arguments from 20 years ago rather than the big issues? We had News Talk ZB's husband and wife duo Kate Hawksby, Mike Hosking, deriding the focus on the incident. Hawksby said, you know, regarding the shouting and the banging on the door, that part's not that shocking. She sort of thought it was just something that happens in student flats, I guess. Look, I'm not sure what types of flats these guys have been living in, but they seem like they're pretty rough, pretty wild places. You know, Hosking, he was actually, until recently, calling for tougher sentences on young offenders. But today he turned the blowtorch back on the victims, accusing them of seeking revenge for what he saw as comparatively non-newsworthy incidents. So here's a clip of that.
And where does it stop? If banging on the door and yelling is cause for a QC, how many other stories of doors out there are there? If behaviour is the critical component here, look at Uffendale all you want. But what about the behaviour and the motive of those that look to destroy a person all these years later?
So basically there's some media angst about whether we should be bringing up the stuff that happened all those years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think that maybe Hosking's criticism there is pretty risible. I mean, just trying to turn the blowtorch back on victims in the first place is pretty iffy conduct. But then, yes, these people are bringing up these stories all these years later, but it's not like it was precipitated by nothing or out of the blue for some reason. I mean, it happened because Uffendale is now the MP for Tauranga. And you go, oh, that's political. But what's wrong with that? He's in a public office now representing a city, and that does come with additional scrutiny. That's kind of part of the job. But also in that original story from Johnston, it was clear that the victim at its centre was pretty happy to let things lie after Uffendale reached out to him and apologised. You might remember he did that sort of 9 months before he launched his political career. And this victim, it's said in the story, he only decided to talk after the MP launched his political career pretty soon after that apology, and that led the victim to feel like that wasn't genuine. So not really a conspiracy here. You'd think that the RNZ victim as well probably saw the news and thought, oh, I'll talk about that. And, you know, you had Tim Beveridge saying, why are these people being anonymous? Well, maybe they want to be anonymous because they're going to get criticized in the nation's most popular morning news show for being part of a political hit job, and they're going to be raked over the coals if they're not anonymous. It's not really, to me, that much of a conspiracy. But anyway, this sort of angst, it's not just come from commentators who might be a bit less than neutral when it comes to their politics. We had on Morning Report on Tuesday, Guyon Espiner. He carried out a really good interview, and he did at the same time seem pretty rueful about it, or at least subdued about taking Uffendale to task. And later on, he explained that tone. He confessed to some conflicted feelings about the story in an interview with the journalism teacher, Jim Tully. And here's how that conversation went.
Did you pause at all when you saw it break? I mean, I did, to be honest. I was like, well, he was 16. And then I looked into it a bit more and thought, well, okay, you know, and looked at these kinds of issues we talked about how he handled it and stuff. Well, did it give you a pause at all?
I think a warning light flashed. But then, like you, the more you look into it, the more you can see, well, in the end, this is something that the public ought to know.
And I will note as well, Guyon Espiner talked about getting a heap of feedback, essentially like what I got, you know, calling him a bully, essentially, for dredging up something that's so far, so long ago in Uffendale's past.
Well, what do you think about this? Where do we draw the line on dredging up the past?
And I think I side with Guyon Espiner and Jim Tully on this one. You know, I appreciate the idea that the things that you do when you're 16, they shouldn't define you for life. You know, if Uffendale had been upfront, contrite about what happened and the media was still hounding him saying, how could you do this? I agree, that's kind of going too far. As people have said, we do all make mistakes when we're young. This is a pretty major one, but that, you know, there has to be some room for redemption. But that's not really how this played out. You know, he wasn't upfront and contrite. As Claire Trevett wrote in the Herald, he was given chances to be open about this incident during his Tauranga campaign. And she noted that he was asked during a Q&A, what was your biggest mistake in life? And he said, not coming home to New Zealand sooner. Look, I mean, I'm no ethicist, but I would say, you know, sneaking into a 13-year-old's, you know, room while they're sleeping and beating them ranks a bit higher than that. I mean, Uffendale has followed the same format even in recent days. So it's not just back then. You know, when Guyon Espiner, in his interview with Uffendale on Tuesday morning, asked him whether more allegations would be reported. This was Uffendale's response.
Yeah, is there anything else that's going to come out?
No, I don't think so.
By the afternoon, he was saying the opposite. He was holding a press conference to tell people he expected more allegations to surface. And of course, the following day, they did. And that speaks to a pattern, I think, of minimization, or at least holding back what you think you can hold back. And that's going to be newsworthy no matter which party you're from or how long ago the incident happened. There's really nothing that journalists hate more than when they feel like a politician might be lying to them or holding back some of the truth.
There's also the fact that he has been very vocal about being tough on crime despite having this stuff in his own history.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know whether this would have blown up quite so much if there wasn't that sense that there's hypocrisy involved here. You know, Stuff's original story on the King's incident noted that in Uffendale's maiden speech, he hit out at what he called a growing culture of lawlessness, lack of accountability, a sense of impunity, and he's since admitted to breaking the law, if not with impunity, then with relatively light repercussions. He went to another expensive private school, and he has failed to accept accountability for those actions until caught out. How could you say those things? You know, that's the point that pundits have made. So literally in a piece for Pundit, Tim Watkin notes, victims of bullying may not see this as such a minor matter. Look, I think that's important to note there. You know, bullying casts a long shadow. I can say that from personal experience. But Watkin goes on to say the incident undermines National's attack on the government as soft on crime, pointing to Paul Goldsmith just weeks ago saying that Labor needs to ensure youth offenders face consequences for their actions and are held accountable for their actions. Well, they might say, you can start with the guy sitting just across from you in your caucus. I mean, in a similar piece for Newsroom, Aaron Smale said the problem wasn't that Uffendale screwed up, but that he was now arguing that poorer, disproportionately Māori or Pacifica children shouldn't get the same second chance as he got. And just finally, in my roundup of all the people making the same point, the Herald's Thomas Coughlin, he took aim at the party's double standards as well. And in a column today, he penned the line, if delinquent youth are getting a free ride under Labour, they appear to be getting a free ride into National. And I just repeat that line mainly because it's very funny. In essence, the argument's this. You can't say tough justice for B, mercy and compassion for me. You can't say throw the book at teenage ram raiders while writing columns saying 16-year-olds make mistakes and calling for understanding. You're judged by the standard you set.
Right. Well, should we go on to something else? Well, we've still got time. You wanted to talk about student party culture in Dunedin. Does this all tie in?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I wanted to say with the last one, there's been a bit of reporting that kind of called out the normalisation of bullying and in some cases homophobia in these private schools. And I liked the reporting. It was Alice Stewart and RNZ, Andrew Dean and stuff. And they're sort of looking at the normal stuff that happens and going, hey, well, not normal, but, you know, the stuff that we just accept happens as a matter of course, and saying, oh, is that actually appropriate? Is this doing lasting damage to people? And I thought, yeah, the student party stuff is a little bit similar. And also there's an interesting parallel to the Sam Uffendale story here, because some of the stuff he's accused of doing happened at as he was a rowdy student at Otago University. So TVNZ's Youth Network, RE News, is actually their full name, put out a really interesting mini-documentary this week about flat parties in Dunedin. And its central figure is the former student Megan Prentice, whose best friend Sophia Cristani was crushed to death in an overcrowded flat party back in 2019. So Prentice plays two roles in this. She's the doco's most important interview subject, and she's also an interviewer herself. So here she is outside the house where her friend died.
We like spent the whole day like getting ready together, got my ears pierced, we like made dinner together.
Yeah,
it's weird to like think back to that day and like know what was gonna happen, I guess.
Gee, that's sad.
Really sad, really moving for seeing her doing that. And she's also, she's very articulate and very strong as a host and an interviewer as well. So she's upset there. She kind of goes through the full range of roles in this. An incredibly tough subject. The doco's key thesis is that flat parties are pretty out of hand in Otupoti. So no huge surprise there, not exactly breaking news. But it argues that the situation has been made worse by efforts to shunt out a lot of the bars like the Captain Cook, or, you know, where students used to congregate. And, you know, those bars had a bit of a reputation, but in Prentice's eyes, allowing them to close has just forced all of the student revelry into flats where it's less regulated and often far more unsafe. And so, yeah, just a normal thing that's happening, nothing that people are really, you know, condemning all the time, but really trying to come up with, you know, taking the status quo, identifying an issue with it and proposing a solution. And I thought that was good, and that's something that a lot of people have done this week, including in the Sam Uffendale story when it's talking about the culture at boarding schools. But also I want to note that, strangely, this is not the only excellent mini-doco I've seen on student culture in Otago University just in the last few weeks.
Oh, what else have you seen?
The second one is by a young collective called the Department of Information. And just to put it euphemistically, it's a bit more... Great name, a bit more raw than the one produced by Ree. It's basically kind of gonzo journalism from the scene of a raging party on Castle Street in Dunedin. So if you're tough enough to endure some bad language and the sound of a whole bunch of drunk students repeatedly putting the interviewer's microphone in their mouths for some reason, then I'd recommend watching it as a companion piece to the one on Ree. It also talks about people getting hurt at parties, but it kind of gives a more, I'll say, first-hand picture of why those injuries take place. And this is about the only clip I could find that's broadcastable on Her Majesty's National Radio Service.
A bit of DMB, a bit of fun, yeah, I don't know what else. Basically, if you dance to the bass enough, you forget about your childhood trauma for a little bit, and that's just a beautiful thing. I kind of go something like... Yes.
Glad I wasn't there.
We probably wouldn't have been we might have been a little bit out of place if we were there, Karen. That should give you a taste of just how this doco goes. It's really fly on the wall. It doesn't offer any commentary around the sides. It's not like the Ree one where it has a real point, but it does give you it's really compelling, actually. It gives you a picture of what the issues could be without actually saying what the issues could be, and it has a really poignant coda, which I won't spoil for you, but the ending is really great.
So what you're saying is that we're coming up with some great youth content here.
Yeah, that is what I'm trying to say. I love both these docos, but it leads me to my last topic, which is a scoop from the spin-off Duncan Grieve. And recently some job ads started going up for Vice NZ, and that struck a lot of people as weird because Vice NZ closed its New Zealand office in 2019. And made all its staff redundant. So Grieve started digging into this, and apparently all these new roles are entirely funded by the Ministry of Social Development as part of its series that it's running, apparently, on teaching teens how to deal with breakups.
Seems like a strange choice for a contract.
Yeah, defunct organisation, right? I mean, strange at the best of times, but I think it's particularly galling, given what I've mentioned about redoing the strong work targeted at young people. And if you're going to target younger audiences, surely a place like Ree, which is a public media organisation that actually employs a bunch of New Zealand staff, surely that would be a better option. Even, you know, maybe Grieve's got a bit of self-interest here. I mean, even the spin-off, which is pitched more millennials but draws in some younger people, could have been a more defensible choice. I shouldn't defame Duncan like that. This is a good story. Giving nearly $2 million in cash to an offshore company, which literally shuttered its New Zealand office to save cash, is pretty indefensible, especially, I think, when you have some really good local options that are investing in people in this country. And that's basically what some of the former Vice NZ staff said to Duncan Grieve as well.
Hayden, what about RNZ? We have Tahi, the digital platform for youth, but we're not broadcasting on a radio frequency or a spectrum.
Yeah, and I mean, Tahi is great. It's just it's a pretty small operation, I think. And we were meant to have a much larger youth operation, but of course that plan, as you know, was sent spinning sideways by backlash over the fact that our youth station might have knocked Concert FM off the airwaves, fair enough, but it meant that this whole youth thing was kind of sidelined a bit. And in any case, there's an argument. The government's invested so much money in media to so much controversy over the last few years. Maybe if we just invested that money in RNZ to set up a more comprehensive public media outfit with, you know, content catering to youth, it might have been a little bit more of a solid investment, and we might have had something like Tahi off the ground that would have been a better destination for some of this Ministry of Social Development cash instead of sending it offshore to a company that's already left our borders to set up its New Zealand office again.
Couldn't agree with you more. Thank you very much, Hayden.
Hey, thanks very much.
It's Hayden Donnell with Midweek Media Watch.